Okay, very good, man. So we can continue with our exploration of dependent origination. And we have, so far, we have been looking at the three first factors, the avijja, the sankhara, and the vijnana. And this morning I want to have a look at the vijnana in nama rupa, the consciousness, and what is called here, translated here as name and form, and the relationship between the two. So first of all, let me just read out the definition of these things, especially name and form, so we know what this is referring to. So first of all, consciousness is the condition for name and form, so vijnana paccaya nama rupa. And with the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. So that is showing us the conditional relationship between the two. And then we have the definition of name and form. And what, bhikkhus, is name and form? It is feeling, perception, volition, contact, and attention. This is called name. And the four great elements and the form derived from the four great elements, this is called form. Thus, this name and this form are together called name and form. So basically, you can see that the idea of nama rupa is all the, what it basically amounts to is the four other khandhas apart from vijnana itself. So it is basically equivalent to vedana, sanya, sankhara. That's basically what name is. And then you have the rupa khandha, which is form. So really, it is all about the experiential side of things, right? So you have, on the one hand, you have vijnana, which is the knowing aspect, the awareness, ability to be aware of things. And then nama rupa is really the experiences, that whatever that experience is all summarized by nama rupa. So these are the two things. And as I was explaining yesterday, just very briefly, the idea is that consciousness, depending on where, what we are intending in this life, how we live this life, what is of interest to us, where we're aiming for, what our purpose is, all of these things, they show us where our consciousness is heading also in the future life, together with the karmic accumulations that we have. And because of that, because our consciousness has already been established at a certain level, that is the vijnana titi, then when you get reborn, consciousness is established, continues to be established at that level. And then you experience name and form as a consequence of that. Right? So this way, name and form depends on consciousness. And also, the vijnana establishes the range of name and form that you're going to experience, depending on where you are reborn, where that consciousness establishes itself. The range is then established as well. So this is the basically what that conditional relationship is about. And but it is a very interesting thing, because once you understand this relationship properly, you understand, in a sense, what it is that makes the Buddha's teaching, in a sense, different from all the other teachings. Because it is in this relationship that you can understand the idea of non-self, and you can understand why Buddhism is the middle way between eternalism on the one hand and annihilationism on the other. So that's dependent origination, right? Dependent origination is showing you the middle way between those two things. So this is what we're going to have a look at now. First of all, I'm going to turn to the Mahanidana Sutta again, and this gives us some more clarity about the relationship between nama-rupa, name and form on the one hand, and consciousness on the other. So this is from this sutta in the Digha Nikaya. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Exalted One, the Buddha, was living among the Kurus, where there was a town of the Kurus named Kammasadhamma. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Exalted One, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. Seated, he said to the Exalted One, "It is wonderful and marvelous, Venerable Sir, how this dependent arising is so deep and appears so deep, yet to myself it seems as clear can be." "Do not say so, Ananda, do not say so, Ananda. This dependent arising, Ananda, is deep, and it appears deep, because of not understanding and not penetrating this Dhamma, this teaching here, Ananda, this generation has become like a tangled skein, like a knotted ball of thread, like a matted rushes and reeds, and does not pass beyond samsara with its plane of misery, unfortunate destinations, and lower realms. So here the Buddha is kind of very gently kind of saying to Ananda, be careful if you think you understand this, because it is a very profound teaching and it has very profound implications if you understand it properly here. So even Venerable Ananda, right, one of the Buddha's most trusted, most knowledgeable disciples, even he may not have understood these teachings absolutely fully here. But also interesting, of course, what the Buddha says here about dependent arising. It is by not understanding this particular teaching here that you are stuck in samsara. This is what makes you stuck, not understanding this teaching. So this is one of the things that you understand when you attain a stream entry. When you become a sotapanna, this is one of the things you penetrate. And that is when you're able to go beyond samsara. Samsara here, described in these memorable terms, like a knotted ball of thread, like matted rushes and reeds. You're like entangled, right? You are stuck. You don't know up and down. You don't know black from white. You don't know right from wrong. And you're kind of running around, tying yourself up into all these views and all these attachments and all these things. Not really being completely not like a knotted ball of thread, it says here. So quite memorable little sayings, and the kind of coming from the Buddha's point of view, of course. And sometimes we need to be reminded of these things to actually be able to see it, because it is not obvious to us at all very often here. So this is what the Buddha says, and of course, just after this, and it's also interesting, it is left out here, just after this, the Buddha and the Ananda, they also discuss about the importance of Kalyanamitta, and this is where the Buddha says that, Ananda says, oh, Kalyanamitta is 50% of the holy life, and the Buddha says, no, it is 100% of the holy life. And of course, this is kind of the point. The point is that some of these teachings, they are so profound, they're so hard to see and understand for yourself, unless you have the eye of the world, right? The eye of the world is the word of the Buddha, not the eye, so the Buddha sees, the Buddha understands what is going on, and then he passes on this profound knowledge to others. And this is why this essential thing at the beginning of the path is the idea of Kalyanamitta, which is also very well expounded in exactly the same sutta. So it's a very nice sutta, this Mahanidana Sutta, lots of profound things in there here. And now we come to the conditionality between nama rupa. Here it is translated as mentality, materiality, which is the same thing as saying material aspects of experience and the mental aspects of experience. That's really all it means, mental aspects and material aspects of experience. So this sutta, instead of going back in the ordinary way and going, you know, from nama rupa back to vijnana, from vijnana going back to sankhara, sankhara back to avijja, what the sutta does instead, when it comes to vijnana, it asks, what is the condition for vijnana? It doesn't say sankhara, it says nama rupa is the condition for vijnana. So this is a different way of looking at dependent arising. It's dependent origination, looking at it from a point of view of 10. In this case, actually 9 links, because there's another factor missing as well. The salayatana factor is missing later on. So it's looking at dependent origin in another way, with 9 links rather than 12 links. So what does it mean if we say that nama rupa and vijnana have this mutual conditioning for each other? They condition each other mutually in this way. What does that mean? Does that mean that everything kind of stops there? Does it not mean that it goes back into, you know, past lives, past eons, etc.? The Buddha is said to have recalled his past lives for 91 eons or whatever. So what does that actually mean? And I think what it means is that when it says it turns back there, it doesn't go beyond that. It means that no matter how far back in the past you go back into past lives, you go back as far as you want, Wherever you go, all you ever see is this mutual conditional relationship between Nama-rupa on the one hand and Vijnana on the other. This is all you see here. It doesn't mean that this particular way of showing dependent origination is two lifetime and the other one is three lifetime. All dependent origination is multi-lifetime. It's about, you know, as many lifetimes as you want. And this Nama-rupa, Paccaya, Vijnana is basically just this, if you look back into the past, there is no origination of this mutual conditionality between these two things. And the same thing, if you look at the standard set of 12 links of dependent origination, it begins with avidya, right? Ignorance. And as we saw the other day, there is no beginning to ignorance itself. So ignorance itself can be traced back indefinitely into the past. You can't find a first point of that either. So maybe this whole idea that it is two lifetime or three lifetime, it's multi-lifetime. It just is a samsaric existence, right? Going across and across. That is perhaps one way of looking at it, which I think is useful. So let us look a little bit more closely at this relationship between Nama-rupa and Vijnana, between consciousness and mentality, materiality. It was said, with consciousness as condition, there is mentality, materiality. Oh, very hard to say that word. Mentality, materiality. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood in this way. If consciousness were not to descend into the mother's womb, would mentality, materiality take shape in the womb? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Right? So this is the first thing. The first thing is this idea that mentality, materiality, the experiential world needs consciousness. There can be no experience, there can be no arising of any existence without consciousness being present. It's fairly obvious, right? Consciousness has to be the basic aspect of experience. If there is no consciousness there, experience cannot possibly exist. Awareness has to be an aspect of experience, otherwise nothing really exists at all. So it's fairly obvious when you look at it in that way here. Of course, one of the interesting things about this particular passage in terms of dependent origination and the broader view of this is the fact that it talks about the descent into the mother's womb. Right? This is the beginning of life. This is what you're seeing here is a movement from one life into the next one here. Right? So this is one of those, because this is a practical example of how dependent origination actually works. This shows you that the practical example shows you that this is about the movement from one life into the next one. There isn't that many suttas that talk about this in practical terms. There is this sutta, the Mahanidana Sutta, and also the Mahatanha Sankhya Sutta. Those two suttas together, they talk about this. And both of them give a fairly similar description of dependent arising as something which is a movement from one life into the next one. So that is one of the, I think, important things that comes out of this. Okay. If after descending into the womb, consciousness were to depart, would mentality, materiality be generated into the present state of being? Right? So no existence, there is no existence at all without consciousness being present. Consciousness is the kind of crucial thing that makes existence possible. And existence, in a way, is just experience itself. So experience in that realm, as that being, as that fetus in the womb, that experience itself will stop. Certainly not, Venerable Sir. If the consciousness of the young boy or girl were to be cut off, would mentality, materiality grow up, develop, and reach maturity? Right? Can there be any development of the body, the physical and mental things without consciousness? And of course, no, nothing happens without consciousness. The whole thing just stops as a because of that. Therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, this is the source, this is the origin and condition for Nama-rupa, mentality, materiality, namely consciousness. So that is just briefly showing you the necessity of consciousness for really, the way I understand this, it is necessity of consciousness for experience. All these other factors are the factors of experience itself. And now we look at the other side of the conditionality. It was said, with mentality, materiality as condition, there is consciousness. How that is so, Ananda, should be understood in this way. If consciousness were not to gain a footing in mentality, materiality, would an origination of the mass of suffering, of future birth, old age, and death be discerned? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Right, so here is this idea. I was talking about this briefly yesterday as well. The idea that when consciousness, if consciousness is not supported by the sankharas, if consciousness is not aiming at anything, if consciousness is not established either in karma, in rupa, or the arupa realm, if consciousness is not interested in any of that, if consciousness is not pointing or aiming for rebirth in any of those things, if that craving for existence has ceased, then consciousness will not gain a footing in mentality, materiality. That is what it's saying here, right? There's no footing anymore. It's no longer supported by that, no longer established in that. And because it isn't established in that, then consciousness itself must cease. Right? Consciousness isn't established in those things, then it must cease. It cannot exist apart from mentality, materiality. And this is what is meant by nama-rupa being the condition for consciousness. Without nama-rupa, consciousness itself must cease. And this is the meaning of this, and this is the profound implications that we will see in a second, which actually means the Buddhist path, the Buddhist way of understanding existence, of understanding what it is to be a being, is very different from any other type of philosophy that is available either at the time of the Buddha or that is available really today as well. Okay, then we come to the final passage here. I will just mention this in brief. I'm not really sure why I included that. Maybe I should have left it out, but let's just have a quick look since it is there here. Therefore, Ananda, this is the cause, the source, the origin, and condition for consciousness, namely mentality, materiality. It is to this extent, Ananda, that one can be born, age, become old, and die, pass away, and re-arise. To this extent that there is a pathway for designation, to this extent that there is a pathway for language, to this extent that there is a pathway for description, to this extent that there is a sphere for wisdom, to this extent that the round turns for describing this state of being, that is, when there is mentality, materiality, together with consciousness. So that passage there is pretty cryptic, right? You wonder, what is this about? And it is actually not as cryptic as it seems. You just have to kind of pull it apart in the right way, and it is not that hard to understand. So again, it's this idea, the extent to which you can born, become old, die, pass away, and re-arise, right? The extent to which the round turns. The round turns is just the idea of samsara going on and on, round and round, right? So the extent to which these things can happen is simply that there is mentality, materiality, and consciousness. That is why these things are there. That's why these things exist, because of that. So this is kind of the final thing which shows you how all of these things actually arise, why all of these things exist. It's all to do with vijnana paccaya nama-rupa, nama-rupa paccaya vijnana. This mutual conditionality is what it is all about. Everything else exists because of that. Okay, so that is the problem. And then we have this other description. I'll just mention this very briefly. And this is to this extent that there is a pathway for designation, for language, and a pathway for description. Right? And what this means is that to the extent that we can talk about anything, to the extent that we have languages and descriptions about anything, all of that always relates back to one thing. Nama-rupa, paccaya vijnana, vijnana, paccaya nama-rupa. This mutual conditionality between the two. In other words, all experiences we have, anything we can be aware of, anything at all, has to do with these things, nama, rupa, and vijnana. There is nothing beyond that. There's nothing apart from that. There's nothing we can talk about beyond those things. So this is really all that is saying. This is the whole world, basically. The whole world is vijnana and nama rupa together. Remember that when the Buddha talks about the world, he always means the world of experience. It's the only world that matters as far as the Dhamma is concerned. And that is why the world is nama rupa and vijnana coming together in this way. And of course, one of the things that also is being pointed out here, kind of subtly implied by this, is that when we talk about things, one of the problems is that when we talk about things, usually if someone is a putujana, we talk about nama rupa and vijnana, we talk about our experience, but we don't really understand it properly. So it is a distorted description, a distorted understanding that we have. We don't describe it in the correct way. We see things as imbued with a self, as being permanent, and all of these kind of things. And because of that, this pathway for language, yes, we talk about it, but we don't talk about it as it actually is. We talk about it in a way that is distorted. We describe it in a way that is distorted. So it is the pathway, but we're not actually talking about the reality as it actually is. It's not the yata bhuta talk. It's a vipalasa talk, right? To use the terminology we were talking about yesterday during the Q&A session. So it is a distorted talk. And this is why the last part here says it is to this extent that there is a sphere for wisdom, right? So it is possible to use that experience of nama rupa and vijnana, to use that in such a way with a clear mind, looking at it after a state of samadhi, and then see it for what it actually is. That is what it means, that this is also the sphere for wisdom. Everything happens within vijnana nama rupa. So you look at it at the right time and the right place, when the mind is pure, there's no defilements there, and then you start to see it clearly here. And then the pathway for description, the description and the language and how you talk about these things, they start to match with the actual reality here. So all of this, what it is saying is that everything in the world, every wisdom, the delusions, everything we have revolves around this one thing, nama rupa and vijnana, conditioning each other in this mutual conditionality here. That is the world, right? That's really what it is saying here. Okay, don't worry too much about this. It's a little bit theoretical at this stage, and it doesn't really matter so much if it isn't 100% clear to you. I enjoy this particular part because I feel it drives home the particular Buddhist way of looking at the world. And this, to me, of course, is interesting because if we can understand the Buddhist point of view, the Buddhist way of looking at the world, it also kind of increases your sense of confidence in the teachings. You know, you have a rough idea how these things work. Now I want to move on to the Kacchanagata Sutta. And this is a famous sutta from the Sanghita Nikaya. And it is very interesting. And this is the sutta which really brings out this idea of paticca samuppada, dependent origination, being this middle way between eternalism and annihilationism. That's what comes out of this particular sutta. So let's have a look at this one. It also exists in other languages. This sutta exists in Sanskrit and other languages as well. And it's very similar the way it is. It comes out in those other languages. This is how it goes. At Savati, then the Venerable Kacchanagata approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Venerable Sir, it is said, right view, samaditi, samaditi. In what way, Venerable Sir, is there right view?" So this again is about stream entry. He's asking about here, how do you become a stream enter? How is your view established on a proper footing? And so this is one way of understanding the attainment of stream entry. It's a different way from what you normally will see in the suttas. And for that reason, it is interesting here. And the Buddha replies, this world, Kacana, for the most part depends upon a duality, upon the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. But for one who sees the origin of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. And for one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of existence in regard to the world. So I will stop there. And so here the Buddha starts off by saying that the world, Kacana, for the most part depends upon a duality, the notion of existence and the notion of non-existence. So these notions, these are the views, right? The notion of existence is nothing else but the sasatta ditti, the idea of eternalism, the idea that there's some inherent quality inside a being that exists. Just another way of saying the same sasatta ditti, something inherent in us existing, something that actually always is there. The notion of non-existence is not, doesn't mean that nothing at all exists, but it is the notion that there is nothing inside of you that is eternal, that will always be there. So when you die, everything will just come to an end. It's roughly equivalent to the modern materialist views that are very predominant, in especially in Western society, but I guess everywhere in the world these days, the idea that things just must end when life comes to an end. It's important to understand that non-existence here doesn't mean, it's not some kind of idea of illusory reality, that nothing really exists, it's all just kind of a play of consciousness and everything is just an illusion. That is not what it means. The Buddha specifically says in one of the suttas in the, this is in the Kanda Samyutta, where he says that, I do not say that nothing exists, nor do I say that thing exists. What I say, now what does it say? I don't say that things exist as permanent, nor do I say that things don't exist at all. Rather, I say that things exist as dependently arisen impermanent phenomena. So the five khandhas exist in this way, as things which arise and pass away, things that are always changing, always moving around. So the Buddha doesn't really, it's not some kind of, this is not an idealistic philosophy, that nothing actually exists. Things exist, but they exist in a particular way, not as permanent phenomena. So this is what he's talking about here. And then he says, this world, for the most part, depends upon this duality. So the world means beings, right? It means humanity. It means the word world here is the word Pali word is loka. And the word loka in Pali is used very much in the same way that we use world in English. In English, the word world can mean it can mean humanity. The whole world says, right? It means humanity. Everybody says. It can mean the universe. You know, the whole world. It can mean the universe. It can mean the planet Earth. It really depends on the context what the word world means in English. And it's almost exactly the same how it is used in Pali, which is interesting and very useful. And it depends upon this duality, right? So these are views about how we look at existence, how we look at the world. And so we depend upon this. And that is already quite an interesting little thing. But that we depend, what it means is that we depend upon our views. Our views are very close to us. We take up these views because we have a sense of self in the first place. The sense of self needs things to support it. If you have a sense of self, you also have a sense of ownership. You own things. You own your body. This is mine. This is my body. The sense of self and the sense of ownership are very closely related. And one aspect of that ownership, one aspect of the upadana, the clinging, the holding on to things, the attaching to things, is the attaching to views. Right? If you have a sense of self, the views come just behind that because you have to substantiate that idea. We have to kind of say, well, what is this sense of self? And then we cling to these ideas as a consequence. We have these ideas. And that is why when you look at the world, you see precisely this. You see that all the vast majorities of philosophy and religions, they have precisely these views, right? Eternalism. It is everywhere in religion. It is found in the Hinduism. You have the idea of Brahma. Brahma is kind of the eternal divine thing. And you have it in Christianity, you know, the Christian creator God. You have it in Islam. All the large religions of the world, and even the majority of the small ones, all rely on this idea of a creative principle, eternalism, something which is always there. And then that, of course, is then reflected inside of us, also in the atta, in the sense of self inside. Actually, it's really the other way around. It's actually we feel the sense of self inside of us, and then we project out onto the universe, and we see the big sense of self in the universe. God, right? Brahma is out there because we feel the sense of self inside of us. We project it also outside of us. So these are these ideas. And then, of course, you have the annihilationist view, which existed at the time of the Buddha already. Right, it's all, these things have always been around, but of course today it is also quite prominent view of the world. Everything is just material phenomena. When you die, everything comes to an end. The mind ceases because the mind is just an aspect of material phenomena. That existed already at the time of the Buddha. Sometimes, you know, we like to think that, oh, today we are so scientifically advanced and kind of we have our understanding of the world is so kind of advanced compared to what it was 2,500 years ago. And then you read some of the suttas and people already had those ideas back then. And then you can assume if you go back in time, those ideas have always been there probably, right? There's always been existed, always been part of the human heritage, so to speak, these ideas. Because there are natural consequences of the sense of self. And because the sense of self, because avidya, because there's no first point of that, it has always been there, these theories would also always have been there. So we rely on these theories. So remember that. What it means is that when you are arguing with somebody, how do you know that you are relying on a particular view? If somebody is arguing with you, saying, oh, your view is wrong, and you get upset when somebody says your view is wrong, you know that you have some attachment there to that view. So you can see that inside of yourself, that there is this attachment to view sometimes. Sometimes you don't like to be challenged, right? You don't want to hear somebody tells you, ah, rebirth is just complete nonsense. How can you believe in that unscientific nonsense? Right? And you say, what? This, you know, I think there's good evidence for this. And that upset that you may have when people say that is part of this attachment, this nisita. You are nisita. You are relying on, leaning on this duality of views for the most part. So it is good to be humble about things. Remember that your views, they are conditionally arisen. Your views is not some kind of reflection of reality at all. They are conditionally arisen, depending on your background, depending on your context. If you are a Christian, that Christian view has arisen because of conditions. If you are a Buddhist, those Buddhist views have arisen as because of conditions. Okay, if you're an Arya, it's different. If you're an Arya, the views are kind of settled. There's no doubts anymore because you have seen things as they actually are. But anything prior to that, these are conditionally arisen views. And if they're conditionally arisen, right, not only are they conditionally arisen, but they are also false to some extent. You have a view, and you know that whatever view you have, unless you are an Arya, unless you are a stream enter, there's going to be some degree of falsehood in those views. You are not seeing things according to reality. You're still deluded to some extent. And because of that, your views themselves are actually false. So remember that. Remember that, first of all, they are conditionally arisen. To some degree, they are false. And when you remember that, it makes you a bit more humble about these things, right? It makes you not so sure of yourself, not so certain of yourself. I am right, everybody else is wrong. You kind of abandon that a little bit, and you become more open to other possibilities. Yes, you still have attachment to your views. We all have attachment to our views. It's impossible not to have some degree of attachment, because that's just the nature of having a sense of self. So you have to have that. But at the same time, you're also a bit more humble about these things. You stand back and say a little bit, okay, let me not argue about this. Let me not be too hot about this, because there is always some degree of uncertainty here. And that is great. When we think like that, it kind of calms down everything a little bit. We don't kind of get into such bad arguments anymore. And we kind of are more more relaxed about all of these things. So just an important thing about views there in general and how it can be problematic. But don't think, sometimes you hear this idea that, you know, you shouldn't have any views, you should abandon all viewpoints. And I think that is also, I don't personally agree with that. And not only don't I agree with it, I think actually it is impossible. It is impossible to abandon all views. We have to have views. It is part of what it means to have an atta, a sense of self, always has views. And if you try to abandon views, you will just take up another one. It's impossible to let go of all views completely. So having views is okay, but remember their uncertainty, remember all of those things, and then you have a bit more humility about it. Okay, so, and then, the Buddha says, and this is where the really, perhaps the most interesting and most powerful part of this little sutta is, for one who sees the origin of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of non-existence in regard to the world. Right? So, first of all, the one who sees the origin of the world, what does it mean to that one sees the origin of the world? You might think that this refers to the Big Bang or something like that, but of course it does not refer to that at all. And again, we need to go back to this idea, the Buddhist idea of what the world is. And to get to that idea, you can go to little suttas like the Rohitasa Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya 4. And the Rohitasa Sutta is the famous monk, or was he a monk? I think, can't remember now. Anyway, he was a deity at that time. But he was previously a monk. Okay, thank you. Okay, very good. Okay. So I try not to hold on to my views too strongly. That's good. Thank you for that. So this is Rohitasa. He said that he wanted to find the end of the world. And he said, I will find the end of the world by traveling. And so he decided to go as far as he possibly could with his psychic powers. And he says to the Buddha, even though I traveled with such enormous speed, traveling along, I couldn't find the end of the world. And the Buddha says, that's right, it's the wrong way to find the end of the world. I'm not going to find the end of the world that way, right? By traveling around, it's impossible. And then the Buddha says this very nice thing. He says that the world is found in this fathom-long body. The origin of the world is found in this fathom-long body with its consciousness. The end of the world is found in this fathom-long body with this consciousness, and the path leading to the end of the world is found in this fathom-long body with this consciousness. So what that means, I think the obvious meaning of that, is that the world, as far as we're concerned in Buddhism, is the world of experience, right? This is really the world, because that's all we can ever know is our own experiences. It is in our experience that the problems of the world arise. This is where we have dukkha. This is where we have sukha. This is where we have neither dukkha nor sukha. This is where the problems arise. This is where everything really exists. And because this is where the problems are, this is what we have to resolve. So it is the world of experience that is meant, and that is what I think is meant also here. So when we say the origin of the world, what we are talking about is the origin of experience itself. So what does it mean to see the origin of experience? And of course, having looked at dependent origination, I'm sure you will know what this is by now to some extent. The origin of experience is when vijnana comes to the end of a life, right? But the vijnana is established in something. The vijnana wants to continue to exist. It is established in one of these realms, if you like, is attaching to things, looking towards the future. Because of that, vijnana continues on to a new life, to a new existence, takes on a new set of nama rupa, which occurs in that particular existence. And in this way, there is the origin of the world, right? The origin of experience, the origin of experience in a particular realm. That world arises then. This is like one realm, one kind of world, if you like, that arises then. And then you pass on from there. You have made some bad karma, so you get born as an animal, right? You get reborn as an animal, and then you take on the nama rupa, which exists in the animal realm. Certain kind of feelings you can have, certain perceptions, certain volitions that are applicable for the animal realm. And you create the animal world in this way. So the origin of the world is this creative activity of the sankharas. The sankharas establishing vijnana in a particular realm, and that moving on into the future in this way. So this is what is meant here. You understand this creative activity. You understand the origin of the world. You understand the origin of experience as it actually is. And you know that as long as the avidya is there, as long as the sankharas are carrying out their creative activity, establishing consciousness in a particular way, you know that the world will always continue to originate. There will always be a new birth, always a new life, always a new set of experiences. The world, experience itself, originates in this way. The five khandhas are perpetuated into the future in this way. Right? So, the one who sees the origination of the world in this way understands that the notion of non-existence in regard to the world, that there is no such thing as non-existence, right? You don't just stop when things come to when you die. You continue, you move on. The notion of non-existence is false. It is faulty, and you know that this notion cannot possibly be true. You see the origin of things. Things originate, they continue. Non-existence, annihilation is false. That is the consequence of that. And then we have the other side of the equation here. And for one who sees the cessation of the world as it really is with correct wisdom, there is no notion of existence in regard to the world. Right? So this is the other side of the coin, which I also briefly mentioned yesterday. The cessation of the world, again, then means the cessation of experience itself. When the consciousness is no longer supported by sankharas, consciousness isn't established in anything, consciousness is no longer interested in any kind of rebirth, right, anywhere. So because consciousness isn't established in anything in this very life, it is not standing on anything, it is not projecting itself into the future, it means that there is no vijnana titti anymore, it's not standing on anything. It means that there is no movement towards that future life because of that lack of being established. There's no establishment in this life, there can also be no establishment in the future life. And then the radical thing is that when that is the case, because consciousness isn't established, it doesn't mean that consciousness continues forever in an unestablished way. Not at all. The radical Buddhist idea is that when that happens, when Nama Rupa is no longer supporting consciousness in this way, consciousness itself must cease. And that is why I was just reading out before, right? With the cessation. Well, here it says with the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. But in the Mahanidana Sutta, it also says with the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of consciousness. Right? And of course, when you see that, when you understand that when the process ceases, when everything comes to an end because there's no establishment of these things anymore, what you understand then is that the idea of a permanent self, something inside of us which continues and lasts forever and ever, that also is false. Everything ceases, everything comes to an end when consciousness comes to an end and when you have eliminated all the sankharas, etc. So this is the powerful insight here. This is the Buddhist way. You can see the distinction. You can see that neither annihilation nor eternalism is true. There is a middle way whereby existence is conditioned by the sankharas, and you keep on existing as long as the sankharas support that existence. Eliminate the sankharas and existence comes to an end. It's a middle way between these two views. Okay. So I hope some of that makes a little bit of sense to you. Otherwise, sometimes these things then need a little bit of reflection, and then after a while, you come to understand at least roughly what is going on. So then comes the last part of this sutta. This world, Kachana, is for the most part shackled by engagement, clinging, and adherence. But this one with the right view does not become engaged and cling through that engagement and clinging, mental standpoint, adherence, underlying tendency here. He does not take a stand about myself. He has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only suffering arises. What ceases is only suffering ceases. His knowledge about this is independent of others. It is in this way, Kachana, that there is right view. Okay, so again, the Buddha says the world is for the most part shackled, right? Vinibandha, this is, bandha is to bind, it's related to the English word bind, so you are literally bound and chained and shackled to these things, shackled by these things rather. Engagement, clinging and adherence, these are all attachments, they're all related to the word upadana in one way or another. Upadana, abhinivesa, upaya, and all of these things are related, are very closely related to the word of attaching to things, holding on to things, clinging on to things, right? So the world is holding on, the world is attaching, especially here, to these views, is what is meant here. But the one with the right view, he does not have these things, he doesn't have this attachment anymore in the same way. Or he isn't, at least he still has some attachment, but he isn't shackled by them, he isn't tied by them to the same effect. Right? This is the stream entry. Still some defilements there, but the main overlying, the underlying defilement of wrong view has been abandoned. So no longer shackled and bound in the same way. And the main issue here is that he doesn't have this mental standpoint and an underlying tendency, and he doesn't take a stand, it says here, about myself. So this is the point of this is that this shows you the root cause of the problem here. What actually is going on? Why these views are wrong? Why this middle way happens? And it happens precisely because you are no longer having this view of myself. The Pali here is attame. Attame could be translated as I have a self. That's a perfectly valid translation into English. So he doesn't have the view. He doesn't have the clinging. He doesn't have the standpoint or the focus or the insisting upon I have a self. All of that has been abandoned, right? He doesn't really think in terms of I have a self anymore. That is what has disappeared here. And you can see why this fits into this whole thing, right? Because it is precisely this view of I have a self which blocks you from seeing that things either that things can exist in this middle way. As long as you have a sense of I have a self, there will be eternalism, or there might also be annihilationism. The self is annihilated. But once that is abandoned, then this possibility of cessation arises from that. If there is a self there, cessation is an impossibility, because the self is something that will always exist on its own, and cessation cannot happen because of that. Only when that is abandoned does the possibility of cessation actually arise. And of course, it's a very important point. Once you see through the sense of self, you see that the self, there is no such thing as a permanent aspect in you, then you see the khandhas for what they are. Right? The khandhas, when you have drawn out this false understanding of things, the false view of things, then the khandhas are just pure khandhas. And they're no longer imbued with this kind of magical quality, which actually was never there in the first place. And that allows you to see the khandhas for what they are. And this is what this next little sentence is about here, right? It says that he has no perplexity or doubt that what arises is only suffering arising, what ceasing is only suffering ceasing. That is what it means to see the khandhas as they actually are. You just see khandhas, there are a bunch of suffering arising and a bunch of suffering ceasing. You have withdrawn the false view that there is a self in there, and suddenly the khandhas, they have no meaning for you anymore. The only reason they have a meaning is because the sense of self was there. Once that is withdrawn, you are able to see them for what they actually are, just as a big problem, something you actually want to get rid of. It's a drastic change in view, right? A drastic reappraisal of reality. And that is why, once you become a stream entry, this idea of cessation becomes such a beautiful idea, because you understand that the only thing that actually ceases is suffering itself. Right? It's good news. Only suffering ceasing. Nothing else is falling away. Suddenly, this whole fear of losing yourself and all that, you see that actually it was groundless in the first place. So this is the view of the stream enter. Only suffering arises. All that ever arises is suffering. All that ever ceases is suffering. So what exactly is this arising and ceasing? And I think that in the context of this sutta, I think that what it means, because we're talking about eternalism and annihilationism and these things, the context here means arising is the arising in a new existence. The ceasing is the ceasing when you come to the end of your life and everything ceases, that's the ceasing. So this to me has more to do with the idea of rebirth and is related to that. One of the problems, I think, within our modern way of talking about Buddhism is that the Vipassana movement has been very, very strong for so long. It's very easy to read things as some kind of Vipassana thing because of that. So it's very easy here to see that, well, suffering arising, suffering ceasing is the momentary thing, right? Always arising, always falling away or passing away. But I think the context in this sutta, to me, makes it look more likely that what is meant here is actually the ceasing and arising when a new life starts, and then the ceasing eventually when you become an arahant and everything passes away, the final cessation of suffering. Anyway, that's just a minor pointer. And so you have no perplexity or doubt about that. You've gone beyond perplexity or doubt. You've seen things for the first time, fully for yourself. And this, of course, is one of the qualities of the stream entry. No doubt, samaditti, right view, has been established. Okay, let's look at the very last part of the sutta. It is in this way, Kacchana, that there is right view. All exists, Kacchana. This is one extreme. All does not exist. This is the second extreme. Without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata teaches the Dhamma by the middle. With ignorance or with avidya or delusion as condition, there are willed activities. With the willed activities as condition, there is consciousness, etc., etc., all the way down to the end. And such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. But with the remainderless fading away of avidya comes the cessation of the willed activities. With the cessation of the willed activities, there is the cessation of consciousness, and such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. All exists is one extreme, sabbang ati, and this is just another way, as I understand it, of expressing the view of eternalism. All exists, maybe another way of translating this is that sabbangati, the whole exists. Sabbang can also mean the whole, right? Not just all, but the whole. The whole exists in a certain way. And some people have argued this is actually an echo of the Upanishadic teachings, the Upanishads, which were the Brahmanical teachings of the day of the Buddha. It has often been argued that the Buddha would have answered to those teachings, right? He would have said, he would have to counter those teachings. He was trying to present his own view of the world. And of course, he had to show how his view was different from the other ones to make any headway with his teachings. So one of the things that he's saying here, all exists, maybe one of these Upanishadic views. I think some people are arguing that. And it's just really just another way of saying the eternalist view. All does not exist is the materialist view, right? Nothing exists. Everything ceases at the end of life. So again, another way of talking about these extremes. Another little thing which is interesting here as well, all exists, sabbang ati, is very closely related to the Sarvastivadin tradition. The Sarvastivadin was one of the very big schools of early Buddhism, and a lot of the early suttas that were translated into Chinese and Sanskrit and all that, they come from the Sarvastivadin tradition of the Sarvastivadin school of Buddhism. And all exists, that is precisely their doctrine, right? Sabbang ati. In Sanskrit, sarvang asti, and sarv astivada. Sarvas is a doctrine of all exists. So there is an echo here, in perhaps also a reply, in a sense, to the Samasthivadin doctrine. That is also one possible interpretation of this particular passage, that here this is perhaps a later, slightly later addition to the sutta, which came later on. If you look at it, it is quite possible to delete that little sentence there, and nothing really changes in the sutta. And it could be. It is possible, because as far as I know, the Sanskrit version of the sutta, it misses that particular line. And the Sanskrit version is precisely the Sarvastivadin version of the sutta. Right? It's interesting. Straight away, you feel a sense of intrigue, right? Okay, the Sarvastivadins have left this out. The Tirvadins have put this in. What is going on here? There's something intriguing going on. Have the Sarvastivadin, have they removed it so as to kind of not compromise their own teachings, or have the Theravadins added it so as to kind of show the wrong views of the Sarvastivadins? Remember, these are very hot topics of the day, right? From a Theravadin point of view, the Sarvastivada is crazy. How can you say that? It's like saying there is a self. But from the Sarvastivadins, they had their own philosophical reasons for, you know, supporting this particular view. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I don't think there is any problem really there. We don't. It's just like a little side issue. In the Katavatu, the Sarvastivadins, they're called the Sabbativadas. They're called in there. So you can look it up, and you can have a look at some of those discussions and arguments that happened. And this was probably some of those discussions happened around the time of Ashoka, about 150 years after the time of the Buddha. And that is probably the origin of the Katavatu. Katavatu is one of the books of the Abhidhamma Pitaka, and one of the quite interesting ones from the point of view of understanding Buddhist history here. Anyway, so I just out of interest, I thought I'd add that little point, because sometimes there's these intriguing little things that you see in the suttas that make you wonder what is going on here. So then the Buddha says, this is the middle way, right? This is the middle way between eternalism and annihilationism. It is the very dependent origination itself. The fact that from ignorance, all the suffering, all existence happens because of that. And existence continues on as long as there is ignorance. The moment you abandon ignorance, existence itself comes to an end. And that existence coming to an end is equivalent to the ending of suffering itself. Nothing is lost. People think, oh, I want to exist. But the point is, you don't understand what existence is. Existence is just suffering arising and suffering passing away. And once you see that, of course, there is no concern anymore about cessation, about the ending of things, about existence itself coming to a halt. Okay, so that is the famous Kacchana Gotta Sutta. And you are, of course, more than welcome to ask some questions about this evening if you wish. I don't want to be too sidetracked by philosophical things, but because I have brought it up, it is my fault that we have gone down this path. So because of that, of course, you are allowed to talk about these things. The reason I have mentioned this, and the reason I have made a bit out of this, is simply because this is really the core of the Buddhist way of understanding the world. This is how Buddhism understands existence itself. And it's a radical departure from all other philosophies. This is what makes Buddhism really different from everything else. And that is why I think it is actually quite interesting, quite important to understand it. If you're not interested, if all you want to do is meditate and abandon your defilement, wonderful. Don't have to worry about this at all. But for those of you who want to go a little bit more deeply into these things, I think perhaps it can be useful. And that's why I've been talking about this at some length. Okay, so that is all for now, and I'll see you again this afternoon at 3 o'clock here.